Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Happy Taco Tuesday.
That's right. I forgot it's Taco Tuesday, and so it is. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call to be on the air. 888-914-9149. I have a note here that came in from Monica, listening in McAllen, Texas. Good morning, Monica. She says, hope you're doing well. I just wanted to ask, what is the meaning of lighting candles, either at home or at church? Is there anything specific that needs to be done or to pray before you light up the candle? Thank you for your time. Okay, thank you, Monica. Well, the motif of a candle in church, for example, or this is true for in your own home, is multifaceted. One facet of this is what Jesus says in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, where he says, you are the light of the world. No one lights a lamp and then hides it under a basket, but rather it is put on a lampstand where it can give light to everyone in the house. So one of the meanings of, in the Catholic Church, lighting a candle, and typically you'd call them a votive candle. And the reason they're called votive candles is because when you light the candle, it's a sign, first of all, the sign of Christ's presence, and how the light disperses the darkness, the light of truth, the light of Christ himself disperses the darkness. So a votive candle has definitely that meaning. Another meaning is that you can light the candle and walk away from it, and it's still lit, it's still burning, it's still showing its light. And it's a way of, and this is why it's called a votive candle. The word votive refers to your choice in what you're praying for. You have elected to pray for a petition. You know, you're asking for the health of a loved one who's ill, or the repose of the soul of somebody who died, or forgiveness for your own sins, or let's stop, you know, abortion. It could be anything. And so as human beings, being bodily creatures, of course, we recognize that when you light a candle and you walk away from it and you go home and you're doing the dishes, or you're, you know, getting ready to go to bed, and you think in your mind, that candle's still there in the sanctuary. It's still lit. It's still emitting light. It's a way of emphasizing in your own mind the reality and the persistence of prayer. So in other words, that votive candle kind of symbolizes your prayer. It's a physical, symbolic thing that reminds you that your prayer is continuously being offered to the Lord. Or if you're asking for the intercession of Our Lady or one of the saints for that reason. And I'll use this by way of comparison to incense. So if you go to Mass at a parish where they use incense, which is great, you may say, why do they use incense? What's the point of that? Is it just to make things smell better? And I love the smell of incense. I don't think you can have too much incense. And yes, I know some people have asthma, so please, I understand. But all other things being equal, I think you can't use too much incense. I think it's wonderful. Well, why do we do that? Well, there's a biblical reason, and that is that in Scripture, we see this in the book of Revelation, for example, in chapter 5, where the angel or an angel gathers up the prayers of all the holy ones, that includes us here on earth, and presents them to the Lord sitting on his throne in heaven in the form of a bowl of incense, a bowl of, imagine the charcoals, and then the incense is what burns, and this fragrant cloud of smoke that arises, it symbolizes our prayers. So the smoke of the incense, and just a little bit, goes a long way. So just a little tiny spoonful of incense on those hot coals can create a really big cloud, a billowing cloud of incense, which is, again, wonderful. I love it. And the primary significance of the incense is to demonstrate, or rather to remind us of our prayers ascending to God as the smoke ascends to the ceiling. It's like our prayers ascending before the throne of God. And that is a biblical motif in Revelation chapter 5. It was also used in the Old Testament priesthood as a way of signifying the holiness of God's presence in the temple and the holiness of him as God receiving these animal sacrifices. The animal sacrifices didn't accomplish anything. They were symbolic only. But the incense was there to manifest the reality of the holiness of what was taking place. I hope that's helpful to you, and I appreciate the email. Let's go now to Don in Warwick, Rhode Island. Good morning, Don. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. My good question morning. Is, this has been on my mind for quite some time. I don't think many people know about it, but who were the 500 people that Jesus appeared to in the resurrection?
Well,
maybe
we don't.
It wasn't the resurrection. Maybe I have the wrong. It was after.
No, you're right. You're right. So it was after the resurrection. We're told that at one time, I mean, Jesus had appeared to many different groups of people, but we're told that at one time he appeared to 500 people at one time. But it doesn't tell us who the 500 people were. It doesn't give us names, for example. What we do know is that these 500 people were disciples of Jesus. You know, they were those who were there when he appeared to them. But he doesn't give us any specific names. This is in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, by the way. It just says he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. But we don't know who exactly they were.
Yeah, I find that so interesting that they should talk about it more.
Well, one reason it's so important, Don, is because it's one of the proofs for the resurrection of Jesus. And here's how it goes. So we have the documentary evidence here that at least there's a claim that Jesus appeared to at least 500 people at one time. Now, this means there were many other times that he appeared to many other people. But St. Paul there says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 6, that most of them are still alive, although some have fallen asleep. So you have these eyewitnesses who are, you could find them, you could talk to them, you could ask them, did this really happen? Did you really see Jesus risen from the dead? And one of the reasons that this is a proof for the resurrection is that countless numbers of these people in the early church who were alive at the time of Jesus, they testified that he did rise from the dead, and they were threatened with imprisonment, with torture, and even death. As the Sanhedrin threatened the apostles, they had them flogged on at least one occasion, for example, and they persecuted them to the point of killing them. So we would have to ask ourselves this question, how could it be that if the resurrection didn't really take place and these people didn't really see Jesus, how would it be that they would be willing to die rather than recant their testimony that Jesus rose from the dead? Now, you might be able to find one person, or maybe, I guess, two, although that's stretching it, who would be so, you know, so fanatical that they would be willing to die for something that they knew weren't true. But could you really find 500 or 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 people who claim that they saw Jesus risen from the dead and they really knew he really didn't rise from the dead? It was just kind of a hoax or it got out of hand, but they knew he didn't really rise from the dead. Could you find hundreds or thousands of them who would be willing to die for something they knew wasn't true? And the answer, of course, is no. It stretches the probability to the point where it's nil. So that's another one of those proofs, because you have to ask yourself, then why would these people be willing to die for something that they knew didn't really happen? And the only adequate answer is that they saw what they saw and they knew that it did happen.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. And I'm just so surprised that we don't hear more about that in church. It's wonderful. Wow. When I heard it, I was so happy. I was telling friends and they were like, no, I never heard that before.
Well, it's one of those, maybe you might say, best kept secrets of the Catholic Church. And that is the powerful proofs for the divinity and resurrection of Jesus, this being one of them. It's an important one. So this is one reason why here on Relevant Radio, we love delving into topics like this so that more people can hear about them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Donna.
Keep up the wonderful work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's go now to Mike in Orange County. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Patrick. So I just wanted to ask you, because growing up, I was taught that, you know, suicide and things like that are just, that's like the only thing that you can be forgiven for. but diving more into my faith as an adult, I've been learning that God judges under circumstance. And working with addicts and such, I mean, I've given you my testimony before. I was an addict for a long time. That it's given me hope because from what I've been learning, you know, addictions and things like that, it could be judged under circumstance. That is something you were surrounded by or pushed into or things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And it gives me hope that God's circumstance may counteract your sin.
Right. I understand exactly what you're saying, Mike, and you're correct. If I can fine-tune the way of describing it just a little bit, this is classic Catholic moral theology that you're referring to here, and I'll put it in these terms. When you're evaluating the morality or immorality of an act, you take into account three sources, three fonts, as the theologians will call them. The first, and they don't have to be in any particular order, but the first is the object of the act itself. What is the act that's being committed? Well, in this case, let's say it's you wind up killing yourself because of a drug overdose. So the act itself, what is the act? What is the object of the act? And we can say in this case, the object of the act is gravely sinful because we don't have the right to take our own lives. God gives us our life. We don't have the right to take it. So the object of the act, you can say, all right, well, that is, objectively speaking at least, that's seriously sinful. Then you have the intention. What is the intention here? Did this person intend to kill himself? And I think most of the time, if I had to guess, the answer would be no. This is accidental. So if the intention wasn't to kill himself, even though the act itself or the object of the act was gravely sinful, we don't have the intention to kill himself. Now, that also gets into the question about what about the anterior decisions, the prior decisions that the person made to start smoking marijuana or to start taking meth or what have you. So there can be grave sin in the background that was, like maybe you've seen these memes where there's a guy pushing over a tiny little domino, and on the other side of it, you know, several ones further is some huge giant block that's going to topple over because of this first little domino that started the chain reaction. That is definitely part of it. But in the act itself of an overdose, did he have the intention to do that? Well, you could say in this case, hypothetically, no. Then the third thing would be the circumstances, which is what you're getting at. What were the circumstances that led up to this? Was there fear? Was there compulsion? Was there mental illness? Did somebody force somebody? That would be compulsion. And all those circumstances also must be taken into account. So when you or I consider any human act, which means something that your intellect perceives to be good in some sense, and you choose to do it, this is not like, you know, belching or snoring. I mean, those are not human acts in this sense. A human act is something that you intend to do, and that usually has some moral content to it. It could be neutral, could be immoral, could be moral. So when you understand how these three fonts of a moral act work, the object of the act, the intention, and the circumstances, you can triangulate and make a very accurate determination as to whether or not this thing is moral or immoral. And would that, you know, more of us were to do that, because it would help us avoid things like that. But that gets to the heart of what you're saying, Mike, and you're right, that circumstances definitely impinge upon whether or not somebody is personally culpable for something. Yeah. I'll give you the last word.
The only reason I speak about it is because I know when I was in my addiction, you know, sin is to know something's wrong and to choose to do it anyways. And it could be venial, could turn it to mortal or whatever. But when I was in my addiction, you know, as much as I wanted to stop and as much as I begged God for something to come forward and stop me, you know, it's just such a hard sin to turn from, that the circumstance of how it started or where you came from could determine, you know, the outcome. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're raised by drug addicts and it's just something that's happened, or if you're, you know, you're whatever the circumstance may be, it's just giving me hope to think, like, not to use it as an excuse to continue to do what you're doing. You always strive to do better. but it gives me hope to think that, you know, the circumstance, God could see all and knows that the position you're in was just too hard to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Let me recommend to you, Mike, the story of a saint. He's a Chinese saint, and he died as a martyr in the year 1900. His name was Saint Mark G. Tianjiang, and he was an opium addict for over 30 years. Now, he wound up dying as a martyr, but for those 30 years, he was constantly struggling with opium addiction. He died when he was 66. And the story about him was that he was a faithful Catholic. He went to Mass on Sundays, and he would go to confession, and the priest would not give him absolution because he said, "How come you're still smoking opium?" "Well, I'm addicted to it." And so for most of those years, he went without Holy Communion. I think the priest was being too harsh with him, but in any case, he wasn't receiving absolution from his sins, but he remained faithful. He kept going to Mass, and he wound up dying a martyr's death, and he was addicted to opium the whole time. And I think, talk about hope and encouragement. Somebody like him, yeah, who persevered in the midst of all that, is pretty amazing, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. You know, and God's touched me with his grace to have almost 9 years sobriety after almost 18 years of addiction.
Congratulations. So, happy
yeah,
for
you. I know the God's grace overcomes all. And, you know, just hopefully, I mean, with the fentanyl and everything, all the problems that are going on today, you know, hopefully it just gets to people in time.
Indeed. Well, thanks, Mike. Keep on keeping on. And thanks for sharing on the program today. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Real life solutions you can believe in. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Interesting article here. Actually comes from Reddit originally, but it was on BuzzFeed, and we'll get a link to it for you, about how people, we were talking about people with drug addictions and things, and this article is called "People Are Sharing Subtle Red Flags That They Are Actually Giving a Cry for Help." And so just a few things here. I would encourage you, if you want to be kind of up to speed on this, maybe take a look at it. Cyrus will get it posted. It's on the show Twitter feed, at @PMadridShow. Recently, Reddit user, and it gives the name, asked, "What is a sign of a cry for help that isn't obvious to the average person?" I wrote a post of the fascinating, important examples of small behavioral changes in others that can be signs that something is wrong. Here's something that they shared. So these are people who shared their perspective on Reddit. One says, "Anger is a sin, especially when somebody typically isn't an angry." "Anger is a sign, especially when someone typically isn't an angry person. The problem is no one likes angry people, so often it's not seen as a red flag." Another person said, "I used to work for a suicide prevention crisis helpline, and someone going very rapidly from highly stressed and anxious to seemingly happy and carefree is a sign of very high suicidal ideations. This seems counterintuitive, but it actually occurs often because when someone is terminally depressed and finally comes to a concrete decision to end his or her own life, he or she often feels a euphoric sense of relief. Just remember, if you have any worries about someone being suicidal, be intrusive. Better someone you love be annoyed than dead." Cyrus, what's the National Suicide Hotline number in case any of this strikes home for people listening. Do you have that handy?
You know, they just changed it.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, they made it really simple, but of course, I'm blanking out, so I'm just going to...
Yeah, I realize I'm asking you on the spur of the moment, but maybe before I finish reading this, if you could find it, we'll share that. Another user said, a big flag is when someone seems to overreact to things a lot, hair trigger temper, or just really getting upset and overwhelmed by seemingly minor issues. My mother used to say when someone is overreacting to something, there are other things going on that they are also reacting to that you don't know about. Makes sense. Another user says, my main tell is my voice. It drops in volume and people have to ask me to speak up. I don't always know until someone comments on it, but invariably it happens when I'm severely depressed. Another person says, typically when my depression gets bad, I will go radio silent with my friends and I won't see anyone. I close in on myself because I don't feel good. Another person says, a red flag is when someone starts giving up really easily when confronted by obstacles. When someone just instantly gives up after a setback rather than persisting and looking for a solution can be a sign that he or she is either too overwhelmed or depleted in energy to cope. Someone else says a sign they think anyway is saying I'm sorry for everything and taking blame for things that shouldn't even have a blame. Someone says... Someone stops caring about their personal appearance and neglects hygiene and grooming because in their mind they're asking, it doesn't matter, so why bother? And so on and so on. There are a lot of other examples of this. And these are not from people, you know, like clinical psychologists or anything, but they're just people sharing from their own experience some red flags that they see. Be worth taking a look at. Any luck with that number yet, Cyrus?
Yeah, it's 988. That's it. 988.
Okay. 988.
That's it.
Oh, there is.
They've really simplified it. It's no longer. It used to be an 800 number.
Okay.
But it is now 988.
That is smart. And I'm glad to know that they did it because anyone can remember that 988. So if you know somebody or maybe you yourself are experiencing some of these feelings or thoughts or what have you, you sense some of these red flags maybe in your own life or somebody that you know. Like that one person said, better to annoy somebody than that person should die because you didn't say anything or try to help out. The number again, Cyrus?
988.
Great. Thank you. Let's go to Christine now in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Say, I have a question regarding vows that through this whole pandemic, Minnesota's kind of liberal, but anyways, I just don't understand. Is there a difference between a vow a priest takes to obey his bishop and a vow we take when we get married? Because there have been so many incidents where I had to call my priest. Sorry, I'm walking my dog.
That's okay. No problem.
Because I had a friend, her first communion came up, and the bishop was saying, no, communion on the tongue for the conversation before. But then I say, you know, I text my priest. He goes, I have to obey my, I took a vow. He would say that specifically. I took a vow to obey my bishop. And then when my daughter was getting fired because of the mandate, I called and I talked to my priest. I said, I know that the bishop isn't allowing any things to be signed. And he again said, I took a vow. So, I also have a lot of divorce in my family, and I'm thankful that you promote the Primal Loss book because there's a lot of hurt there. Yeah. So when someone takes a vow, is that two different vows, the vow with a bishop versus a vow with... Do you understand my question?
I think so, yes. So in the Sacrament of Holy Orders, when the priest is ordained, he makes a promise to his bishop. Now, we're talking here about diocesan priests because we should make a distinction between diocesan priests versus religious orders where a man might be ordained as a Dominican friar, for example. So we'll come to them in a minute. But for a diocesan priest, he makes a promise of obedience to his bishop. And that encompasses a variety of things, but they're not specifically vowed the way in the case of a religious order they make these solemn professions of their vows. And so the final step would be your solemn profession, your final profession, as it sometimes is called, when you vow. In most religious orders, they have the three evangelical councils of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Those are the three that are typically vowed. Other religious orders, like the Benedictines, for example, they have an additional vow of stability. The Jesuits have an additional vow of obedience to the Pope. So the core typically would be poverty, chastity, and obedience. And in the case of obedience, you're vowing obedience to your lawful religious superior. The corollary to that, or the analog to that, in the case of a diocesan priest, is this promise that is a solemn promise that is made to the bishop. And the terminology seems to me denotes the distinction between the religious life and being a secular priest, being a diocesan priest, for example. So it has this, in terms of its net effect, it has the same force. So the priest who's diocesan, he has made this solemn promise to his bishop to be obedient to him in all things that don't involve sin. For example, if the bishop said, "Hey, I want you to go out and find a girlfriend," he doesn't have to obey that. You know, he does not have to obey a bishop telling him to do something sinful. But in all the things that the bishop is lawfully the competent authority to dictate, he does have that authority. Now, you asked about marriage. Well, it's interesting that in marriage, the sacrament of holy matrimony, one pronounces the vows. And in marriage, we vow fidelity. We vow to be with each other till death do us part, in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, etc. Those are the typical formulas that you'll hear. And it's a vow that's made to God, but it's made more immediately to your spouse. So you made that vow to your husband, he made his vow to you. And before God, you're both making the vows before him. And it's a different vow, but encompasses the same things. You know, you're not vowing to be poor, you're not vowing poverty, but you are vowing to be faithful to one another and to stick together. So there are different nuances, but ultimately you're making a promise to do something that is permanent, or in the case of marriage, until death do us part. Does that help? Does that explain it in a way that makes sense?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And then remember when they used to say and obey, that that was something that seemed like it was important, and then they removed that, the church did. So the I was just trying to distinguish between obey your bishop and obey, you know, your spouse with that vow that you took. And it was just, you know, the words matter. And so I was interested in the difference between a vow and how one is obedient to one vow and not to the other.
Well, the issue there gets to the question of headship in marriage. And as the Bible is really clear, as St. Paul said, the husband is the head of the wife. And so I realize that that's an unpopular view nowadays, but it's still the truth. The husband is the head of the wife and the head of the home, properly understood, of course. So with that in mind, that's one reason why the phrase obey. Now, I haven't studied this, so I don't know. I haven't looked at what the reasons were given for when the rite of holy matrimony was changed, whenever that would have been. And I suspect without having looked at it, I suspect that maybe that obey part was omitted because they wanted to emphasize the mutuality of the marriage covenant, the marriage contract, the mutuality and the equality between the man and the woman, prescinding from the question of headship, because the man is not going to vow obedience to the woman. And so it may be that the reason that that part was omitted was because it would thereby further emphasize the mutuality of this vow, that the two are equally vowing to each other all that is entailed in the marriage covenant. Anyway, I suppose we could talk for a long time, but I hope these things are helpful to you, Christine. Thank you. Let's go now to Sandra in California. Hello, Sandra.
Hi, Patrick. My niece is getting married, and she's a Catholic baptized, marrying a guy who's Catholic but not practicing. Okay. If I go for the wedding, will it be sending a wrong message to her?
Well, what are the circumstances?
We're not getting married in the church.
Okay. Yeah, that's where the problem lies. So he's a non-practicing Catholic. She's a quasi-practicing Catholic.
Yeah.
And the church's law stipulates the canonical form, which means getting married in a church and mm-hmm. have the marriage blessed and officiated by a priest. Could be a deacon. Could be a bishop. Mm-hmm. Now, has she sought permission from the bishop for a dispensation?
I don't think so.
Okay. I would inquire about that, because if she worked with her parish priest and was able to secure, even if she didn't initiate it, if the priest said, well, you're going to need to get a dispensation from the bishop for this, she might say, oh, okay, well, how do I do that? And he may say, well, I'll write the letter and I'll see what happens. So it could be that she was granted a dispensation. And in that case, if the bishop permitted it, then you could go, because all other things being equal, it would be considered a valid marriage. If she did not receive a dispensation from the bishop, then it would, objectively speaking, be an invalid marriage. Because in order to be a valid marriage for a Catholic, you have to follow the canonical form. In which case, it puts you in a predicament, because now you love her and you want to support her and be there for her, all of the above. But now it has introduced this reality that it's an invalid marriage, which really complicates things for you and the rest of the family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because her parents are not going, because they're very staunch Catholics, and they're not going, and I'm the auntie.
Yeah.
She called me. So.
What if you said to her, what if you called her back and said, listen, niece of mine, whom I love, could you just get married in the Catholic Church? You can have the wedding reception wherever you want. You can do, have the wedding reception at the beach or whatever. Could you just, for the sake of your parents and your family, just get married in the church so that we can be there? Mm-hmm. And she may say, well, I don't see why that's important. And you could say, well, okay, but for all the rest of us, it is very important, because we love you and we want to be there to support you. We want to be there to celebrate with you. And this one little thing that the church asks of you, it's not that you have to move a mountain or cut off a limb or anything. It's just, could you just get married in the Catholic Church with a priest there? Maybe as the auntie, you might be in a position to sway her to do the right thing, or at the very least, to work with her to help her get a dispensation from the bishop, in which case everybody could go,
Okay. Thanks
Couldn't
so much.
Hurt. You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Do I understand how vexing and painful this situation can be for Catholic families. And I just want to go on the record and say, young people, young men and young women, if you're going to get married, why put your family through this? Why do that to them? Your mother and father love you. Your brothers and sisters love you. Your family and friends love you. They want to be there for you. They want to celebrate with you. They want to make merry with you on your big day. But if you, as a Catholic, are not willing to just do one small thing, and that is what the church asks of you, to get married in a church and have the priest officiate, why wouldn't you do that? I mean, how hard-hearted or callous or stubborn or selfish does somebody be to say, I know I'm going to cause a lot of heartache and division in the family that could last forever, but I want what I want, and I want to get married at the park or at the bowling alley or at the beach, and I don't care that my mom and dad and brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles and everyone else are going to be put in a predicament. I don't care, because I want what I want. I don't understand that mindset, personally. So my heartfelt appeal, if you're in that position, you're thinking about getting married, my heart, and parents, if you have a son or daughter in this position, grab the link to this part of the show and send it to them. My heartfelt appeal is, just do the right thing. It costs you nothing. You don't lose anything. You can still have the big celebration and the mariachis and the fireworks and whatever else you want to do. Have it at the park. Have it at the beach. Have it in the mountains. Do any of that that you want. But just love your parents enough to get married as the church requests of you to do. That's all. It's so easy to do. And you will avoid what could be lifelong pain and division in your family. Who wants that? I don't want that. Anyway, enough said. We'll take a break. We'll come right back to the phone calls right after this.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Taco down!
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Taco down!
I know what I'm having for lunch. And it's not a PB&J, that's for sure. Okay, marriage question alerts. This comes in from Sandra, listening in Green Bay. And this email just came in this morning. So shout out, Sandra. Thank you for taking time. Not suitable for children. So just know that if you have kids, say high school age or down, just turn the radio down for maybe 2-3 minutes. And then we'll resume our normal programming. Fair warning, ready, steady, go. So she's in the subject line has to do with impotence in marriage. So after listening to you twice explain what's allowed in a marriage that experiences impotence, I have to vehemently disagree. My husband of 45 years experienced it during the last 2 years of his life due to ALS. To deny him the ability to achieve sexual satisfaction due to, and this is all in caps, archaic Catholic sexual teaching, was not emotionally beneficial to either of us. We had a very satisfying relationship all our married lives, and to deny him satisfaction because he could not complete intercourse would have caused more additional emotional damage than he was already going through. He passed away peacefully, receiving the sacraments at home with me sitting beside him. Okay, Sandra, well, first of all, my heartfelt condolences to you. I cannot imagine the pain that you must have experienced at losing your husband in 45 years of marriage. What a wonderful gift that God has given you. So all I will say is that nonetheless, even though you vehemently disagree with me, I'm sharing you what the church's teaching is. And it's based upon, it's not based upon anything archaic. It's based upon the nature of human sexuality, which is always the same. Human sexuality is the same today as it was 1,000 years ago, as it was the same 10,000 years ago. So the human person and human sexuality as such are what they are always. And so I understand, or at least I think I do, I'll try to understand from an emotional standpoint, the church's teaching on this issue and when completing what otherwise would be the marriage act is permitted and when it's not. Obviously, if you don't accept it, that's up to you. But my position here on the program is not to customize what the church teaches, but rather to say this is what the church teaches, and to the best of my ability to explain why the church teaches this. So I would respectfully say that if you're dismissing the church's teaching on this issue simply because you believe that it's quote-unquote archaic, then I think maybe if I could recommend anything, it would be to think more about what it is that the church is teaching here. Now, obviously, I promised I would give a brief answer for the sake of the rest of the people who are listening. But I would refer you to Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body. That's not at all archaic. Pope John Paul II, you know, as you know, died in 2005, and he too was explaining the underlying moral principles surrounding human sexuality. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm afraid you and I will have to disagree on this issue. Thank you for writing to me, though. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ted now in Ewing, New Jersey. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Patrick. You had a caller last Friday who spoke about astrology, and he was struggling with. He wanted to look at astrology, but he sensed that the Catholic teaching discouraged that. And you gave a great answer and great guidance. But one thing that he said was he felt like it was not being able to look at astrology as a Catholic. He felt like it was negatively affecting his identity. And that's what made me think, mm-hmm. actually, it's the opposite. Your identity is your Catholicism. Your identity is a Catholic man. Your identity is a son of God, and the astrology and the New Agey stuff in the outside world is the stuff that negatively affects your Catholic identity. Mm-hmm. So I just hope he's listening, and I hope he considers that
yeah.
who he is not based on being able to look at astrology and whatnot. Who he is a Catholic man, the son of God. Anyway.
Yeah, you and I find ourselves, we discover our true identity only in the light of God's presence in our lives. And
exactly.
that's where we discover who we really are. As you say, I'm agreeing with you. And if I'm thinking of the same call, it must be the same call. It was just yesterday or the day before, the gentleman was saying that he likes to read the horoscope because the
yeah.
horoscope helps him, you know, order his life and decide what to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I agree with you that his attachment to it involves some kind of intellectual or emotional pleasure that he doesn't want to let go of. And I guess he won't let go of it until he's ready to see that this is something it in the hierarchy of goods, this pleasure that he feels in reading the horoscope is way down the list of goods. And we have to subordinate the desire for those pleasures, whether bodily or intellectual, to the higher goods that have a claim on our will that we should choose above the lower goods. But I agree with you.
Yeah, agreed. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Ted. Appreciate it. Let's go now to Anna in San Bernardino. Hello, Anna.
Oh, hi. Oh.
Hi.
Uh-oh.
You're on the air.
Hi. Oh, I am. I'm online. I'm
hello
sorry.
There.
Hello there. Good morning. Reason I'm calling is about the Eucharist that we were talking earlier. And, you know, our church is going to celebrate 70 years this year, the Feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And our pastor would ask our bishop several times if we can put our tabernacle back in the center of the church, up at the altar area, because we have a Blessed Sacrament chapel. And originally in the old church, it was in the center. Excuse me. And then when we built a new church and dedicated in 2006, then it was placed in the back, which is in the Blessed Sacrament chapel. Well, now we have a new bishop. And again, he asked our new bishop, can we put our tabernacle back in the center of the sanctuary? And he said yes.
Okay.
And we're really excited. We purchased a new tabernacle that's going to go back where it belongs. And when the church originally was built, it was built with the purpose of having the tabernacle, according to our previous pastor, the tabernacle up in the sanctuary.
Okay.
So we're really excited. But I was also surprised that several people were fighting it.
Yeah.
They were saying, no, it doesn't belong up at the altar. And I think it's that mentality that we have now that Jesus doesn't belong at the altar. So,
yes, but I've run into that before, and it always makes me sad when I encounter Catholics who have been radicalized because they have gotten a hold of some bad liturgical theology in some cases, or maybe they've been radicalized because they have a distaste for traditional piety and they look down on people
mm-hmm.
who are pious in a traditional way. It could be any number of reasons, and it's not for me to know, I guess, but as I said earlier, and by what you're saying, this is an example of that, that the pendulum is beginning to swing back in the right direction. And so
yes.
there are people for whom that's anathema. They don't like receiving communion on the tongue. They don't like kneeling down. They have a whole long list of things they don't like. And all I can say is, well, get used to it, because the church is
yeah.
recovering her sense of equilibrium, and that's the future. If you want to live in the if you want to live in the present, join us. If you want to live in the past, I don't recommend it.
Yeah. What I see, though, is it's also the younger generation. A lot of them are getting more, I guess, Orthodox or more. My daughters, actually, one of my daughters drives about half an hour, 45 minutes to get to a church that has the railing.
Mm-hmm.
And and they wear their veils. You know, I've been starting to wear my veil for the past 2 years now.
That's beautiful.
And I think there is a turning point right now, and especially now with the Eucharistic revival. So
I'm really happy to see that too.
See that tabernacle.
Yes. Well, these are good signs, the signs of hope and encouragement, and I'm all about that. One thing to remember is that, as the old saying goes, the church is ever ancient, ever new. So the church is always alive in the moment. We don't live in the past. We don't live thinking about the future. We live in the now. And so there are some, in recent decades, and maybe even more recently, some obstacles to progress and attempts to try to prevent the church from enjoying her patrimony. This too will change. As time moves on and the church progresses, these things too will pass away. All things are passing, as the Bible says. So just be faithful and persistent and love the Lord and love your neighbor as yourself and all the things that we're called to do. And as time progresses, things will progress as well. Thanks, Anne. Appreciate the call. Let's go now to Adil. I hope I'm saying it correctly. Good morning in Temecula.
Good morning, Patrick. It's Adiel.
Welcome, Adiel.
No problem. Thank you. Well, I had a question. I'm currently talking to an ex-girlfriend after 2 years of being broken up and not communicating with each other. And her and I have decided to get to know each other once again because we're young and we've changed a lot since our last relationship. Now, in the past, I didn't make the best decisions due to my immaturity and indecisiveness and many other things, but I plan to go talk to her parents to apologize for my actions in the past. And I've been asking and praying to St. Joseph for his intercession to help me humbly apologize. Yes. And I want to know if there's anything else I should do to be in the right mindset stepping forward and making sure that God's always front and center.
Oh, great. Well, obviously you're doing the right thing by wanting to make amends if that's necessary. Now, you're going to be apologizing to the woman herself or to whom?
I have to her, but it's mostly to her parents because there were times when they wouldn't want us to go out and I'd take her out and I'd go against their will. They didn't support the relationship.
Yes.
And I felt like I was splitting them up.
This is really noble and mature of you to do this, Adiel. So hats off to you for doing this. If you're asking about like how can you properly prepare, I think obviously if you're preparing prayerfully, I like the fact that you're bringing St. Joseph into the picture, asking for his intercession, maybe make a novena to him to help you do this effectively. That will go a long way. Pray the rosary. Pray for the parents, obviously, that they would be willing to receive your expression of regret. I'm sure they will. They'll probably be blown away by it. I know I would be if I were the dad. Also, I would say fortify yourself with the sacraments. So Mass and confession in preparation for this momentous day. And then I would just entrust everything to the Lord and say, Lord, you know my heart. You know I want to do what's right. This is what seems right to me. Please help me. And I'm sure he will.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome. Does the woman in question know that you're going to do this?
Yes, she actually already mentioned it to her parents. She asked me if I wanted to, if I was sure if I wanted to do it, and I told her, you know what, I'm having second thoughts, but I'm just going to put it into the hands of God and pray about it. And yeah, she said that they're okay with it. They're expecting me. So,
I think you can't go wrong, my friend. Talk about putting things on the right foot the next time around. I mean, if you're going to restart this relationship with her, to get off on the right foot this time with the parents especially. See, as a father, having 6 sons, 5 daughters, and 6 of them all are married now, I can tell you that one of the things that my wife and I are looking for, we're scanning and looking for, is this man or woman who's going to marry one of our children, is this person virtuous? Is this person honest? Is this person have a good character? Is this person, you know, all those things that we would look for. So even if the first time around, if, you know, your failure to launch, as the saying goes, didn't work out the first time, if they see that you've had a change of heart, I can only imagine that they're going to feel a great deal of confidence that if it does work out between you and this woman, their daughter, that they would know that you are you're a man of integrity and humility and the kinds of things that they would want in a son-in-law. So it seems to me that no matter what happens with the relationship, you will have done a really good thing, certainly in the eyes of these two parents.
perfect. Well, I appreciate those words, Patrick. It means a lot. It helps me feel more confident about what I'm doing.
I'm glad. Well, do me a favor, Adiel. I'm interested now. So as things develop down the road, let me know how things are going. I'd love to hear how this meeting with the mom and dad goes and what their reaction was.
Okay. Will do.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. That's great. Cyrus, when the time comes and your daughters start contemplating marriage, are you ready for the talk when the young man comes to you and asks you for your permission to marry, for him to marry your daughter? You ready for that?
La, 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 la. I can't hear you. I can't see you. I don't want to think about any of this.
Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah. It'll happen. It'll happen, you know, and it's actually a really cool rite of passage. And as dad, you will, I think you'll be very comfortable with it. And I like the thought of the young man doing this because it's a way of recognizing this woman that he wants to marry and her place in the family as a beloved child of her parents, a beloved daughter of her father, a beloved member of the family. And therefore, the whole family is involved. Certainly, the parents are. I think it's a great thing. So be sure to call me, Cyrus. I want to zoom in on that conversation you have with the guy when he asks you to marry your daughter. I'd just like to just to watch and see how you do.
Yeah, you'll be the sixth or seventh person to know, for sure.
I'll be like the Olympics judge with the card. I'll hold up the number. 9.8. 9.9. Cyrus is blushing. It's okay, Cyrus. All right. Well, until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.